Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. We recently celebrated the life of Nancy Reagan and the marriage of Nancy and Ronald Reagan upon her passing, and you can listen to the full hours we've done, and we did too, at ouramericannetwork.org. Today we bring you a story of her husband for our This Day in History segment that's brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about the Constitution, our nation's history, the arts, literature, all the things that matter in life. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale will come to you through their hugely popular and free online courses at hillsdale.edu, and it features some of the best professors in this country, the kind I didn't have in college, frankly, and I didn't even have in some of the best law schools I'd been to in the country. I attended one of the best. And on this day in history, well, it's St. Patrick's Day, named after the Irish saint, a day that President Ronald Reagan, like many Americans, celebrated heartily. In our local paper, the Oxford Eagle, we bumped into a story about President Reagan's celebration. It was from nationally syndicated columnist Tom Purcell, who graciously recorded it for us. Here's Tom.
On St. Patrick's Day, 1988, when President Reagan arrived at Pat Troy's Irish Pub in Alexandria, Virginia. As news got around town, the pub quickly filled to capacity. While Reagan enjoyed a pint of harp and some corned beef and cabbage, Pat Troy was so busy tending to his patrons, he didn't have time to react to his famous customer. "He had an energy about him," Troy told me. "It made it easy to carry on as though he were just another patron, so that's what I did." Troy took to the stage and led the audience in the wild rover. He directed different sections of the audience to compete with each other. "You have to clap louder, Mr. President," he shouted, causing the president to laugh out loud. Troy next led the audience in the Unicorn Song. While he sang the words, the audience mimicked the animals referenced in the song. There were green alligators and long-necked geese, some humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees, some cats and rats and elephants, but as sure as you're born, the loveliest of all was the unicorn. "Green alligators and long-necked geese, some humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees." Reagan turned to watch a group of young women act out the song. His face showed curiosity and delight, as though he'd never seen this song performed before. But that's how he was. At the same time he was the world's most powerful leader, he was a man of youthful innocence who found immense pleasure in the simplest things. Troy then handed the microphone to the president. The raucous crowd became silent. Reagan spoke off the cuff.
"First of all, a very great thank you to Pat Troy, the owner of this particular place."
Then he talked about his father, an Irishman.
"My father told me when I was that high that the Irish built the jails in this country and then filled them. But I just want you to know, I'm very leery about ethnic jokes now in my position. The only ones I can tell are Irish."
Reagan then talked about a visit to Castle Rock, where St. Patrick had erected the very first cross in Ireland.
"And the young Irish guide who was showing me around took me through the cemetery, and he stopped me by one very ancient, large tombstone there. The inscription on the tombstone read, 'Remember me as you pass by, for as you are, so once was I. And as I am, you too will be, so be content to follow me.' And that was too much for some Irishman of more recent vintage, who had scratched underneath, 'To follow you, I am content. I wish I knew which way you went.'" "Why didn't I find this place 7 years ago?"
The pub visit was recorded by Reagan staffers and released 10 years after Reagan left office. I watched that video. I got to see a snapshot of pure unscripted Ronald Reagan. It showed how powerfully and eloquently the man was able to engage any audience, large or small, just by being himself. As we work through the process of selecting our next president, we sure could use another leader like him. In any event, as I celebrate St. Patrick's Day this year, I'll offer up my own toast to the great communicator. To follow you, we were content and grateful for the way we went.
And that's a great piece. We got Charlie, who helped us with that. And thank you, Tom Purcell, for recording that. And it's just so great to hear one of our great public speakers and one of our great presidents just going out to a place where everybody goes and talking like we all talk. And my goodness, that the Irish built the prisons and then we filled them. Yeah, he's right about ethnic jokes. You can't tell him anymore, folks. That could end up putting you in jail too. And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And I think we all have a St. Patrick's Day story, and I have one too, because my best friend got carted away in a melee in New York City. Well, because when my Irish friends drink, well, they like to just get and mix it up and get into some arguments. And there was a little bit of a scuffle, and the next thing you know, he was carted away at 16 years old and not taken to jail, just taken away because he needed to be removed. And it was a humbling moment for him and, well, a funny moment for all of us because we heckle him to this day about maybe just having one pint less on the big day. And that's a tall order for an Irishman on St. Paddy's Day to have a pint less, a Guinness or whatever it is that you prefer on the great day of St. Patrick's Day. To all of you wearing green, to all of you who refuse to wear green, shame on you. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. More after these messages.
Some people call me the space cowboy. Yeah. Some call me the gangster of love. Some people call me Maurice. The pompousness of love. People talk about me, baby. Say I'm doing you wrong, doing you wrong. Well, don't you worry, baby, don't worry. Cause I'm right here, right here, right here, right here at home. Cause I'm a picker, I'm a grinner, I'm a lover, and I'm a sinner.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories. Whenever we talk to folks about what's going on in their minds, especially parents, we inevitably circle around to what's going on with this younger generation, the millennials. By the way, every generation judges the generation after it. And Steve Toback recently wrote a piece on Fox Business called The Millennial Mindset and America's Productivity Crisis. And it's now out with a book called Real Leaders Don't Follow. And that expands on this topic. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
You know, in your article, you ask us to stop doing three things when it comes to thinking about the younger generation. What are they? Just go run them down bullet by bullet for my audience.
Well, the first one is quit trying to deal with a certain generation as if they're either special little snowflakes or entitled narcissistic brats, and start holding them accountable as unique individuals.
All right.
The second one is, that said, those unique individuals need to quit doing such an effective job of living up to those Generation Me stereotypes. Put on their big boy pants and get to work. And the third one is, this is my favorite, and their coddling parents should quit acting as if they had absolutely nothing to do with the demon spawn they raised and stop blaming gadgets, schools, and society in general.
Well, you know what? We love them, Steve, and we're hearing this. It's interesting. We're hearing this from parents, but the parents are always talking about someone else's kids, and everybody's talking about everybody else's kids, and in the end, we're all doing this, and we're all blaming something else. So let's talk about the coddling parents first, and dig in with that, and this generation of parents that have produced this generation of kids.
Well, I think that's sort of the greatest irony of what you just said, that everyone's sort of talking about other people's kids. it's even worse than that. Everybody's talking about the kids being the problem, and the real problem, obviously, is the parents.
Of course.
You know, kids did not make themselves this way. Certainly not an entire generation. And by the way, you know, as I said up top, it's, you know, the whole profiling a generation thing is a bit funky, and I caution against it. But nevertheless, they are doing a pretty good job of making us see them a certain way. But at the end of the day, we clearly made them, and we made them what they are, and they and. You know, one of the principles of my new book, Real Leaders Don't Follow, is that real leaders do things by, you know, they teach by example. And where did the kids learn this kind of behavior from? They're living in an entitled society. And the entitlement goes all the way up and down the food chain. It includes the government bureaucracy. It includes... Oh, you know, CEOs who make big bucks, a lot of them get great exit deals when they fail.
Yep.
You know, it's just the kids are learning it from everybody.
Well, and you know what else they're learning?
You know, blaming the kids, you know, it's a double-edged sword.
It is. And, you know, it's interesting. I counsel through my church periodically couples on finance. And they don't seem to know how to just stop spending money. They can't stop. And they want to save, and they want to buy a house, and I'm trying to teach them what that means. And so we're looking at their budget, and I'm looking like coffee, Steve. And they're like, oh, we can't give that up. No, we can't give that up. And my parents, like, I ate out once a month. That was it. And it was McDonald's, and I was allowed one burger. That was it. We took one family vacation before I was at the age of 10. One. We got in a car, we went to Niagara Falls, and we came back. And so how is our materialism, in a sense, and look, this is no socialist show, but how has our own materialism contributed to a part of this?
Well, it's obviously huge. It's sort of funny how, you know, sort of what goes in hand in hand with what I call the entitlement society is that nobody wants to give up their stuff. And I mean nobody. We're all, you know, sort of addicted to, you know, at least a few things. And it's sort of funny, but if you look at, you know, how successful people really behave, you know, what you'll find is they never really live beyond their means. They just don't.
Yep.
And I know I don't. My wife and I have never done that. And I'll tell you a funny story, but you know, we bought a home in Silicon Valley 21 years ago on a fairly large property. And the home was sort of run down. And we lived in that run down home on this beautiful piece of land for 15 years. And by the way, I was, you know, way into my 40s. No, early 50s before we actually put one penny into that house. And it was only after we had, you know, done quite well in the world and it was time. And my wife used to always look at me and say, you know what? We are the poorest living well-off people I've ever known.
Yep, yep. So true. You know, my wife.
And it's the truth.
My wife and I finally built our first home that was really something we want. I've just turned 55. And it was because we saved. We saved and we lived in tight quarters and all of my friends had much bigger houses. And I just said, well, bless your hearts, but you can't afford the house you're living in. And I always think my parents taught me you live in the house you can afford to live in. You say the millennials need millennials, though. In the end, these kids are going to have to figure it out for themselves. You're saying they need to get to work. What makes you say that, Steve?
Well, the big issue here that the reason I wrote the article, actually, the column, is that we have a strange situation in America where millennials have now become the largest generation. They are the largest demographic to hit the workforce. And they're also, unfortunately, the most unemployed, underemployed, and indebted generation probably in modern times.
Yep.
And what's happening, and this is really interesting, we've sort of been wondering why it is that the unemployment rate has been dropping, and we're sitting, you know, in the neighborhood of 5% now, but at the same time, the labor force participation rate is at its lowest since 1977.
Yep.
So the reason those two things, which seem contradictory, actually jive, is what's happening is millennials in record numbers are opting, they're not climbing the corporate ladder and building their career that way. They're not creating new companies as they were once, it was once thought that they would over all the hype over the new entrepreneurial generation. Instead, they're opting for what, you know, what they euphemistically call solopreneurship. And what they're really doing is becoming self-employed. And unfortunately, the problem with that is the self-employed people in America, and this is, you know, Bureau of Labor Statistics data right out of the book, are way, way less productive than the average worker. Just a quick fact, self-employed people now amount to 17% of the workforce in America, but they are only generating 7% of the GDP. So if you do the math, that means the self-employed people who are sort of opting for the convenience and the perceived benefits of being on their own are about a third to 40% as productive as the average worker. So the problem here is we now have, you know, guys like me and you, Lee, we have the boomers starting to retire if we can.
Yep.
And, you know, maybe wanting to take advantage of some of the entitlements that we paid into. And the generation that's supposed to be sort of helping to you know, keep the coffers full, well, they're almost empty anyway, but at least keep them going and fund all of the entitlements that we've built up in this country, are the least productive we've ever had. And it's a bad combination.
It's a really bad combination for us and for them. And, you know, it's interesting, this Uberization, because I don't know how many young people I meet who, well, they drive an Uber car, they're performance artists on the side, and what they're not learning is that sometimes giving up a little of that freedom can actually make your life a whole lot better. The other thing is, as you know, when you're self-employed, you've got yourself as a boss, and that doesn't always work out well. I really appreciate what you wrote, and what I'd love to do, Steve, is bring you back for an hour to talk about your book. Break it down, get through the chapters. We had you on for this one article, but it sounds to me like there's a lot longer we can spend together than just these 12 minutes. So would you come back?
Absolutely, I'd love to.
Well, we look forward to it. That's Steve Toback, and his book, Real Leaders Don't Follow, is what we will dig into. What we were talking about is the millennial mindset, which he wrote at Fox Business. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear this and hear everything we do. Take a listen, particularly to Jesse's really good work on the Walt Disney, the great Walt Disney film that I won't even mention here, so you have to go to the website and see. But it's a unique look into this film that you've, a story you've never heard before, only on Our American Stories. More after this. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and now for our weekly Marriage on the Mind segment with our marriage coach, Deb Wolniak. Deb is the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. And every week, Deb joins us for storytelling about marriage. This week, Deb speaks with Audrey and David Dolphin, fellow Sheboyganites who have been married for over 70 years, in a romance that, well, has produced over 50 children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And we now bring you their conversation.
I'm David Dolphin from Hingham, Wisconsin. This is my lovely bride of 70 years. And we were married back in 1945.
Six. You got out of service in 45.
Okay.
Tell us how you met.
Oh, my.
Oh, boy. This is a real story.
My dad was a minister, and we moved. I was born in Michigan. We moved to Nebraska. We moved to Iowa. And then we came to Wisconsin. And I was 8 years old, and my dad would, my folks would usually invite people over after church at night, and invited her folks, and her and I sat under the kitchen table kissing.
He was about 8 and I was about 5. Isn't that terrible?
That was the start of our romance.
So when you guys got to be teenagers in high school, I mean, now you're talking, you're getting close to the time you went into the military. What happened with that?
Well, I went in when I was 18 years old.
And I was a junior in high school. So and we just decided we were riding. We were going, but I guess you'd kind of call it steady in a way, but not that we had rings or anything. But we decided we were going to keep real close contact with each other, right?
Right.
So we did.
I went in on January 13, 1942. And that was about a month and a week, 5 weeks after Pearl Harbor. And went in the Air Corps mechanics.
And so you return home. What happens next?
Her dad was in business here in the feed mill business in Hingham. When I was home on furlough, he asked if I would run it. Then he would buy it, see? So I said, sure. So 2 years I worked for him, and then I bought half the store, and then a couple of years later I bought the other half. And I was looking for leather gloves in the store, see? And nobody came around, no salesman. So I called Wolverine Worldwide in Michigan. I said, say, where's your salesman? And they said, we're looking for one. I wanted to get out of the grocery business. You know, that's just counting pennies.
Well, that was 16 years in the grocery store. Yeah.
16 years. And they said, we're looking for a salesman. They said, are you interested? And I said, I might be. And they said, well, you name a place in Milwaukee and we'll fly over and interview you. But bring your wife along. Because if your wife don't agree with this, no soap. So I worked for them for 3 months.
When he was interviewing, he talked to him after he was finished. He said to me, would you trust your husband on the road? I said, why, sure. I said afterwards, I said, that was kind of a dumb question. Why'd you ask me that? He said, if you don't trust him, we don't trust him. So now they wouldn't dare to ask a question like that anymore.
So 3 months, I was top salesman in the United States, or one of the top four. And I thought, by golly, if I could do that for them, I can do it for myself. So I started the Whitewater Glove business up.
So rewind the clock back to the point where you said, I think we got to get married. How'd that come about? And then what was your wedding day like?
I was teaching school. I was teaching in a one-room rural school. And we decided June was just too long to wait, and so we'd like to get married in February. Then as quick as my brother got out of service, we wanted him home too. So as quick as we knew the date, we set it, and you didn't have to wait then for anything to get a haul or anything, you know. And his dad was minister, so of course he was available. And we decided we'd get married, and I asked the school board if I could have off Thursday and Friday. So I was married on Thursday, and we went to Chicago for overnight and came back on Sunday, and I was back teaching school on Monday.
Then I put the kibosh to it and got her pregnant.
You can erase so that too.
That's the end of her school teaching.
So what's the secret to being successfully married this many decades? I mean, 7 decades. That's amazing. You know,
when we were married 50 years, the park in Florida had anniversaries. And the year they celebrated the 50th anniversary, there were 13 couples celebrating. But this is right after the war, so everybody got married that year, see? And the master ceremony said this is the only generation, I think, that will ever be able to do something like this, because those before us didn't have the health to get to 50 years. Those after us don't have the commitment. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Sad, but true.
That's right. I said, when we were married, we knew it was for life. You made an agreement, and this was until one of us passes on, goes to the Lord. His dad died when he was 68. My dad was buried on his 70th birthday. So we have been married longer than either of our fathers lived. That to me is just... But when you start to think about how long it is, we didn't get cards from people our age. We had so many cards last week when we were married 70 years. But they're from church members and people we've met during the years, and some from vacations we've taken. But, I mean, the people our age, our friends, are all gone. That's the hard part.
How do you guys communicate?
Communicate?
Yeah.
Car, huh?
Well, that's the way we get from one place to another. How do you talk to me, dear?
Oh, loving, kind words.
Always.
Do you say yes, dear, a lot? Or
yes, dear. That's my one list, or what is it, your one
list?
My
honey-do list, yeah.
My honey-do list.
We don't have a problem. We don't always agree on everything, and we have a good argument once in a while. One of my college friends said to me once, her and her husband had never had an argument. And we went home and talked about it, and I said, I think that would have been a terribly boring marriage. Really, true. Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You have to disagree. We never have an argument that lasts. And I said my mother's favorite Bible verse, I think, was, let not the sun go down upon your wrath. And you always made up before you went to bed.
So what would you say to challenge future generations, or maybe even younger marrieds or younger folks that are thinking of getting married? What do you want to encourage them on today?
Clean living for one thing, huh?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
And a dedication to know that it's not a contract that you break in a year or two. It's a contract that you've made for life.
Mm-hmm. Now the young people think, well, we'll try it. If it don't work, so what?
Right. And you've never had that feeling. I mean, even when you had an argument, you knew it. You were going to get over it because you had to live together.
Right.
And it's worked out pretty good.
Right. And clearly you've gone through all sorts of life stages.
Yep.
Probably health, ups and downs, loss of family members. Lots of stressful things sometimes.
Really, I think the worst thing that we ever went through was the IRA audited the business one time, and that is a stressful thing. No, I lost 20 pounds. Now I'd like to be able to.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you guys so much for sharing, and congratulations.
Well, there's nothing to say. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. When we come back, we'll talk to Deb about this remarkable couple. I could listen to them for another 10 minutes. More after this. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories. You're listening to the great Chris Stapleton, and we love his work. And you just heard from Audrey and David Dolphin, fellow Sheboyganites, where Deb Wolniak works and does what she does. Married over 70 years, 50 children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren combined. And what voices they had. And Deb is our marriage coach. She's the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, a group whose innovative couple-to-couple mentoring programs has an 87% success rate in saving struggling marriages compared to 28% with traditional counselors. And Deb, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
You know, Deb, one of the things they talked about, and it's one of the things that my pastor had shared with me, and whether you have a pastor, whether you're a believer or not, is of no material relevance to this particular point. And that was, let not the sun go down on your wrath. And that's something that has changed my marriage. Burying a fight and being compelled to by rules we create within our marriage. The single thing that's made my marriage better. And my wife would say the same thing. Talk about that and this couple and those simple rules.
Yes. In fact, communication is probably one of the number one things that couples ask us questions on. How can I better communicate? Clearly, you're looking at in this couple somebody who has longevity, and you can hear it in their voices. They like to still laugh together and enjoy each other's time and company. If you saw the video on this, which I have, and I can try to give to you guys to post, I'm telling you, this guy is winking. He's having a great time, and he's in his 90s. They enjoy spending time together because they've seasoned together. Clearly, they've developed a strong pattern of communication and represent that to their children, their grandchildren, et cetera. This is a couple that is legendary, not only, frankly, in this area for their longevity, but also will be for generations to come. So personal application, I want couples to start thinking about how they communicate, what's the tone of their communication on a general day-to-day basis, and what kind of things would they like to see improved. That whole theory about do not let the sun go down on your anger is so absolutely 100% true. You can apply that across the board, whether you're faith-based or non-faith-based. If, I will tell couples this, if it's getting late and you're extremely tired and you feel that the tiredness is starting to impact the quality of your conversation, one thing you can do is agree to pack away the topic for the evening and consider getting additional help and coaching to maybe go through that situation further in a pattern of communication that can be healthy and productive. And let's face it, we do have some things in our lives, depending on what stage of marriage we're going through, especially if it's the explosive stage, that could be very difficult, and you may not be able to solve it in one night. It's something that may have multiple layers, and that's where you build your team around you so that you can individually dissect each part of that equation in order to continue to grow and heal and become unified in spirit and in mind in order to address that topic directly.
You know, the agreement, though, to put it off is something you actually find common ground on. And, you know, there's a great moment in Ed Rollins' essay on Nancy and Ronald Reagan, where Ed had the sad luck to be right behind the Reagans during a fight. And he had overheard Ronald say to Nancy, you know, Nancy, I heard you the first time, and I heard you the second time. I don't need to hear it a third time. And then he said he watched them walk away, and then he watched Ronald, just before they got on an elevator to go into a public reception, kiss her on the neck. And so somehow in their own way, they had coded or worked together a way to resolve things. And I think that's, you know, ultimately you can develop some of these techniques, but it's just fascinating. Even the President of the United States and his bride, who by all accounts, everybody thought had a perfect marriage, would fight and fight right in the open in front of an aide. So, you know, the coping mechanisms are big. You know, you talked about, there was something in that interview that was fascinating. There was David's potential employer asked her if she trusted him on the road. Would you ever see an employer do something like that today, Deb?
Well, bringing your spouse to an interview is something that would be unusual. But I will say, in some job interviews, depending on the type of job, the spouse is critical. And I'll give you an example. It's actually out of my own life. My husband works for an organization called InterVarsity. It works on college campuses, coaches leaders on college campuses. It's a student-led movement. Some of you may know it. Anyway, the reality is when way back in the early 90s, when he was offered the job down in Milwaukee at Milwaukee School of Engineering, I was invited along to that interview. And part of the reason why is because it takes great dedication to walk away from a situation where you're earning a serious income into more of a fundraising scenario. And they had to make sure that the wife was ready to make that commitment, because I'm telling you, financial is one of the biggest changes and things that can impact the stress of a marriage. And we were both committed to that goal. And so we obviously entered that and been doing it for almost 25 years in his vein. So the exciting thing about that is, yes, it can happen in certain pieces. And yes, you know what? Think about this, guys. Your character, your true character, comes out in your marriage. If you think you're all that in the workplace and you're doing awesome in sales and you are killing it, climbing the corporate ladder, if your marriage sucks, you know what? That's a really hard thing. It's hard to be happy in your workplace when the home life is struggling. And I've seen a lot of people try to fake it till they make it. And I'm going to tell you right now, if you keep ignoring it, it will undercut everything you do in business. One of the best things that I've seen some people do, including, believe it or not, a professional athlete up here in Green Bay, has taken time off his next season in order to focus on family. And that says a lot about a person's character and also their priorities. This is tough because we have to sometimes do a gut check, and we don't necessarily like the answer that we're hearing. But whatever you do, don't ignore the gut, because it will tell you what needs attention. And if you don't pay attention to it, it will pay more attention to you. And you may have to think about that at a more serious time later. Take care of it now.
Yeah, you know, I had a good friend of mine who's in a law firm, and his partner had really neglected his marriage, building up the partnership. My brother's not married, but he had always said, look, we can slow down. A, I have a girlfriend, and I love golf, and B, you know, but he kept driving it and driving it and driving it. Of course, the marriage went south, and then an epic divorce. I mean, and as he said it came out of nowhere. Of course, it didn't come out of nowhere. And literally, it shut down the practice. He couldn't practice, and he lost everything. I mean, he lost his wife, he lost his kids, and he's only now, 2 and 3 years later, back to being like anything close to his former self. And he's now running the firm in a very different way with the employees and everyone else. But he had to learn a really hard lesson. And boy, the cost was really high, Deb. And I'm sure you hear and see that more than you'd like.
Yeah. Right. Well, and I even tell, we work with corporate clients as well in servicing them in some of their work environments in a lunch and learn fashion. And why are they bringing us in? Because they know relationships at home affect the workplace. They also know, as human resource professionals, they can't go to the private side. You know, they can't ask, hey, how's your wife doing? That's personal. You got to keep business, home. But inviting us in allows us to be able to teach healthy relationship practices, and people start gleaning some things. They start going, oh, I need to improve my communication. Here's some tools that I can take with me, not only to apply in the workplace, but at home. And when the spouse comes home and tells their other spouse, hey, I learned this at work today. What do you think about this? The conversation starts and opens it up. And just even talking about it is the first step. Check with your spouse on where their gut is at and how they feel your communication is going. And by the way, look at them in the eye when you do it, for even more than 10 seconds. I challenge you to do it, because it will actually start changing the tone of your marriage. And you want that to be healthy and growing and positive. You can do it.
No doubt. And Deb, we got about a minute and a half left. But one of the things I noticed there was that this couple had a pretty spontaneous wedding, not a gigantic honeymoon and all that pressure that comes. And now the amount of money and time spent on this wedding day and the pressure. Just give about 45 seconds. Talk just briefly about that, if you could.
Yeah, average wedding cost nowadays is upwards toward $30,000. I know some people who have student debt that is comparative to buying a house. One of the things you've got to do is you've got to set yourself up correctly financially. Let's get realistic about why we're there for the wedding. It's for the spouse and dedication of your lives together, and literally becoming one flesh, one mind, one spirit, one body. It is literally a miracle. Start focusing on that and where your relationship preparation is, because if you're not ready to walk down that aisle and look at that other person and know that you know why you're marrying that person, what are going to be the challenges, what are your strengths. If you can take care of that before you're married with programs like Prepare and Enrich, you're going to be way farther down the road than those people who didn't take time to do that before they're married and are still struggling 10, 20, 30 years later.
You
bet. Set yourself up right. It's more important than the wedding dress.
You bet. All that time on the pre-wedding celebration and post on the marriage. Spend it on preparing that marriage. This is Lee Habib, Marriage on the Mind with Deb Baldiak. Deb, thanks as always for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And OurAmericanNetwork.org is where you can catch all of this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we like to bring you reports about all kinds of things in life. And tonight, we bring you a story from AAAR Shanto, our roving food correspondent. Take it away, AAR.
Have you ever wondered how the food television genre started? I'm AAR Shanto with Our American Stories. Today we sit down with what I dubbed, well, the godfather of the foodie television movement, Mr. Graham Kerr. And for all of you millennials that watch the Master Chefs, the Iron Chef, the Food Network, at the time that this gentleman began his career, there was no food television at all. And that's one of the things that I asked Mr. Kerr when we sat down to interview him for Our American Stories.
I was in the Air Force in New Zealand. And, you know, it's a long story before getting there, so we don't want to bother with that. Mm. And they came in to me one day and they said, "We want you to go on telly." And I said, "Excuse me? Telly. But there isn't any television." Well, there will be next month. Well, why me? Well, the physical instructor has sprained his ankle, and they wanted somebody on Battle of Britain Day, and so he couldn't do his physical jerk, so you're going to have to go on and cook something. The Air Force thought I was terrific. Apparently, so did the TV critic. There were, by the way, only 50 television sets in the whole nation. There was only one channel, and it came on at 6 and went off at 10. And I was between Peyton Place and the Avengers.
Now that Graham Kerr has started his TV debut, well, his wife, Trina, she wasn't really excited about all the things he was doing.
First of all, she said, "I could care less about food. I'm not in the least bit interested in food. You give me the first 6 minutes, and then you can do your food thing." So I thought,
yes.
Well, what happens first? You run in front of a live audience. You're really good with live people. And so you don't just want to look steadily at a camera. You want people all around you as you're cooking. Mm-hmm. So you run and you shake them by the hand. You grab a glass of wine. Yeah. And then you jump over a dining room chair. And then you tell a joke.
Wow.
What's the point? What is the point of a joke if the whole idea of the program is food? She said, "It is so as to relax you and relax your audience and have a good laugh, and then you can cook."
Wow.
So she got the first 6 minutes. And she said, "You know, really, television is not about information. It is about entertainment.
Yeah.
And you must entertain first before you inform."
And that, my friends, is how the Galloping Gourmet got its start. You see, the person I'm speaking of is known as the Galloping Gourmet. His television show became one of the biggest cooking shows ever on television. Over the years, Graham had much success. He was on Johnny Carson. He was on David Letterman. He's been on Rachel Ray. He's been on the Food Network. Graham Kerr, the Galloping Gourmet, has made a name for himself with the help of his lovely wife, Trina. These days, you'll find Graham Kerr still cooking in front of a camera, going on shows, but his newest project is focusing on his life and trying to help others find their place in their life.
We call it Flash of Silver, and I was watching one day in a local river. I live up in the northwest of the United States, in the Pacific Northwest, and I watched a Chinook, which is called a king salmon, making its way upstream against some pretty white water, and it's throwing itself at this white water with such vigor. And I knew enough about salmon to know that this salmon was within weeks of the end of its life.
Yes.
It was probably a 7 or 8 years old about that stage. And I looked at that and I had this idea in my mind. I hope that when I get to the end stretch of the river of my life, that I can throw myself at adversity with that kind of vigor.
Wow.
With that kind of determination. And from that time on, I began to start to inquire after the entire life cycle of a Chinook salmon. And I began to see that there were elements in that life cycle that were extraordinarily like all of us as human beings. And I know, I don't know anybody else who's ever compared a fish with a human. I know it's wild. And my wife, Gina, said, really? I don't think so. Yeah. And but on rite of passage number 5, she said, I have grown to love these fish.
Wow.
And I really know what you're getting at now. So have you heard of the book Pilgrim's Progress?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not daring to suggest that I'm in any form comparing it, except I must. It's an extended metaphor,
yeah,
is what I have done. And I have thought that it may just, it won't compete with that, but it may just find its own place, and people will be amazed about how it actually begins to speak into their life.
As you can see, Mr. Kerr is still changing the lives of many. He changed the lives of many on television with his cooking, and now he's changing the life of people, letting them know that age makes no difference. I'm A.A.R. Shanto with Our American Stories.
A.A.R., great job, and I call you A.A.A.R. sometimes just in jest. But A.A.R. does our food beat, and I remember the Galloping Gourmet, and so do so many Americans, and it's good to see he's doing what those salmon are doing. He's out there, and he's still working, and he's still putting himself forward for the American people, telling stories, and, well, entertaining us. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Go to Our American Network to catch all of our material. Everything's up there. More after these moments. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And each day we bring you the news around the world through one through line, one subject line, and we call it Jesse's World.
A woman took a live turkey on a Delta Airlines flight for emotional support while on vacation. Jody Smalley from Seattle, Washington, was spotted using her yellow-beaked turkey, she named Easter, as a therapy pet during her two-hour flight to Salt Lake City. After the plane touched down, she lovingly pushed the feathered creature through the airport in a wheelchair before taking it to her brother's house. Miss Smalley says her turkey offers her comfort and reminds her on a daily basis there's a reason to smile and to care no matter how bad things are. The turkey was allowed to travel on the flight under the Air Carrier Access Act of 1968, which legally permits customers to fly with emotional support animals. The turkey sighting comes nearly a year after a 29-year-old woman was escorted off a U.S. Airways flight when her emotional support pig started defecating on the floor and squealing loudly. Bull crap might not be worth much, but bull semen is another story. $50,000 worth of bull semen was recently stolen out of a truck in Turlock, California. You heard that right. Bull semen. So why on earth is it worth so much, you might ask? Well, this particular sperm came from the top 1% of the world's bull population, the Hugh Hefners among heifers. It holds a lot of genetic value and is used to impregnate cattle around the world. The stolen fluids in question was reportedly enough to impregnate more than 1,000 cattle, who are now utterly disappointed by this sick act of thievery. The victim of the theft, Anthony Reese, said that it took months to collect the valuable genetic material. We'd rather not imagine that process. Anyone with information regarding the missing semen is asked to call the Turlock, California Police Department. And speaking of California, motorists in Northern California have been dealing with a new kind of road hazard. Overly aggressive coyotes who may have consumed hallucinogenic mushrooms. At least two of the coyotes have been staring down motorists on Highway 1 in Marin County and striding into the road. When a driver stops to avoid hitting the stoned coyotes, they usually sniff around the car before running off. Lisa Block of the Marin County Humane Society says she's had to warn dog owners about the fly agaric mushroom, a psychoactive mushroom that grows in the area. These coyotes may have stumbled upon a stash. For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
That was great, Jesse. Good job. We love Jesse's World. And I'm telling you, when there are certain things, when you're doing animals, this is just, they're always the best. Hopped up coyotes in California roaming the streets. What a story. And stolen bull semen. Come on. It can't get better than that. Oh. And so we have to move from that to our this day in history today. And from the sublime to the serious, today in history, the Challenger explodes. And not too long ago, we had brought you the story of Buzz Aldrin. And we love the story of space and space travel. And today it's being done by some of our greatest entrepreneurs. And by the way, that's how we got in flight in the first place. The Wright brothers did it, not the government. Though if there is one place where some of us can agree we should spend some money on government, it might be NASA. It's one of those rare times when you'll get some Republicans and Democrats. And again, we don't do that kind of show, but it's one of those things where, my goodness, getting to the moon, what a thing to do. And what a great thing for a country to have achieved. And if there was one perhaps setback to NASA, it's that they kept doing the same thing over and over again. And some people were thinking, well, why don't we get to Mars? Buzz Aldrin thought that way. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and listen to that Buzz Aldrin segment. It's extraordinary. But on this day in history, a nation watched as the Challenger exploded. And nowadays, we are so used to our gadgets sending signals to and from space with satellite TVs and GPSs that we probably don't even think about just how wondrous any of this is, space exploration. And my goodness, have there been tragedies down that road of discovery. Read The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe. It gets it all. The ups and the downs in that industry, the deaths, the failed experiments, and the movie. I've got to tell you, one of the great movies based on a book. He got it right. Hit it out of the park. Well, on this day in history, in the year 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded in front of the nation's eyes and school kids' eyes, because everybody watched, because a school teacher was on that flight. They wanted to take an ordinary American and have an ordinary American go into space with the crew. And, well, let's bring you back to that moment on live television and the report of that fateful accident, that tragedy, at 11:39 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
This shuttle mission will launch, my God.
1:15.
There's been an explosion.
Velocity 2,900 feet per second, altitude 9 nautical miles, downrange distance 7 nautical miles. This is not standard. This is not something that is planned, of course. I can see a solid rocket booster has broken away from Shuttle Challenger. That's what you're looking at in the middle of your screen. I cannot see the shuttle itself.
By the way, kids around the country again were watching this, horrified. And it didn't take long for the world to know. And again, imagine a day when there were only a few channels. There wasn't cable. There wasn't CNN. And at 6:30 that night on the NBC Nightly News, well, here's how it began. Again, millions of Americans tuned in, as they always did, especially on those days with fewer TV channels, and especially on such a tragic day, to see their trusted anchor. And that was Tom Brokaw.
NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw.
Good evening. Tonight from Washington, D.C. It was a nightmare, a cruel, shocking end to what everyone expected to be another triumph for the space shuttle program. The Challenger, with a school teacher and six regular astronauts on board, was consumed by a giant fireball explosion less than 2 minutes after it was launched into the bright blue Florida skies at 11:38 Eastern Time this morning. The path to space was filled with debris and with death. All seven people were killed.
The crew of seven included schoolteacher Krista McAuliffe from Concord, New Hampshire. Again, the first teacher in a space, leading classrooms across the country to tune in live, unknowingly exposing millions of children to the utter tragedy that had fallen her. And with no filter, there it was. Well, in 2011, NPR interviewed one of those teachers whose classroom was glued to that TV. Her name is Ellen McKinney, and she still is an elementary school teacher in McCall, Idaho. We take you to this really good conversation.
It was a very exciting time. We were working to learn as much as we could. We experimented with toys in space. We watched training videos that had been provided to us through NASA. We played with rockets. We had stuff exploding. It was just a really fun time.
Krista McAuliffe was the first regular person to go up in space, and sort of perfect that she would be a teacher because it would bring, in a way, all the kids along with her. Speaking before the launch, we have a clip of tape of her here. She seemed to be thinking really more about the teaching profession than the fact that she was going up in space.
I was delighted that a teacher was chosen as the first space participant because there are so many of us who have daily contact with people. And that was a very exciting thing for me, to think that teachers were finally recognized as the good communicators that they are and that they reach so many students.
Did that give an extra glamour, if you will, to being a teacher?
It did. I think it brought recognition to something that we hold near and dear to ourselves. And Krista was just such an exemplary person, and she went as a teacher.
That tape comes from a profile that I had prepared to go on the air the night of the launch, and it turned from a profile of the crew into a remembrance. Take us back to that morning.
We had divided the 600 kids in our school into half of them in the library, half of them in the gym, had television monitors at that time. And when the T-minus started, there were cheers and exuberance, and we counted down, and then it was silent. We stopped talking about what was happening. We'd been saying, now watch for the solid rocket boosters to come off. We're going to be seeing that any minute. And then they weren't happening, and then the explosion, and the kids quieted down, and we needed to tell them something's gone wrong. And they kept asking, you know, are those people dead? And we had to tell them yes. And that was probably one of the hardest things.
You bet. My dad was the superintendent of schools at the time in New Jersey. And that was not only a tough day, it was a tough week. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And when we come back, you'll hear the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, addressing a grieving nation. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And on this day in 1986, the Challenger exploded. We left off. Ronald Reagan was supposed to deliver the State of the Union address to Congress that night. But he couldn't. He wouldn't. Instead, he addressed our nation with these 648 words straight into the living rooms of America.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd planned to speak to you tonight to report on the State of the Union. But the events of earlier today have led me to change those plans. Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country. This is truly a national loss. 19 years ago, almost to the day, we lost three astronauts in a terrible accident on the ground. But we've never lost an astronaut in flight. We've never had a tragedy like this. And perhaps we've forgotten the courage it took for the crew of the shuttle. But they, the Challenger 7, were aware of the dangers, but overcame them and did their jobs brilliantly. We mourn seven heroes: Michael Smith, Dick Scobie, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and Krista Mikulov. We mourn their loss as a nation together. The families of the seven, we cannot bear, as you do, the full impact of this tragedy. But we feel the loss, and we're thinking about you so very much. Your loved ones were daring and brave, and they had that special grace, that special spirit that says, "Give me a challenge, and I'll meet it with joy." They had a hunger to explore the universe and discover its truths. They wished to serve, and they did. They served all of us. We've grown used to wonders in this century. It's hard to dazzle us. But for 25 years, the United States space program has been doing just that. We've grown used to the idea of space, and perhaps we forget that we've only just begun. We're still pioneers. They, the members of the Challenger crew, were pioneers. And I want to say something to the school children of America who were watching the live coverage of the shuttle's takeoff. I know it's hard to understand, but sometimes painful things like this happen. It's all part of the process of exploration and discovery. It's all part of taking a chance and expanding man's horizons. The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. The Challenger crew was pulling us into the future, and we'll continue to follow them. I've always had great faith in and respect for our space program, and what happened today does nothing to diminish it. We don't hide our space program. We don't keep secrets and cover things up. We do it all up front and in public. That's the way freedom is, and we wouldn't change it for a minute. We'll continue our quest in space. There will be more shuttle flights and more shuttle crews, and yes, more volunteers, more civilians, more teachers in space. Nothing ends here. Our hopes and our journeys continue. I want to add that I wish I could talk to every man and woman who works for NASA or who worked on this mission and tell them, your dedication and professionalism have moved and impressed us for decades, and we know of your anguish. We share it. There's a coincidence today. On this day, 390 years ago, the great explorer Sir Francis Drake died aboard ship off the coast of Panama. In his lifetime, the great frontiers were the oceans, and a historian later said he lived by the sea, died on it, and was buried in it. Well, today, we can say of the Challenger crew, their dedication was, like Drake's, complete. The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them, this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God. Thank you.
You almost tear up just hearing that. And that's what we love to do here at Our American Stories. Not a clip, the whole thing. And by the way, what a thing to tell young people. And by the way, every young kid was up watching that. I was, and I wasn't young. Love it when he said the future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. By the way, it might have been a very good thing for these kids to see that. We shelter our kids too much. They can get stronger from these things. And they can learn what bravery looks like. Well, a few days later, the president and the first lady flew to Houston for a memorial service. And they sat in between two of the astronauts' widows. And Reagan later recalled, quote, "I found it difficult to say anything. So all we could do was hug the families and try our best to hold back tears." Well, by the time he stood before 10,000 NASA employees, guests, and the families of the astronauts, Reagan found his voice again. After eulogizing each extraordinary member of the crew, he turned to their families and said this:
"The sacrifice of your loved ones has stirred the soul of our nation. And through the pain, our hearts have been opened to a profound truth. The future is not free. The story of all human progress is one of a struggle against all odds. We learned again that this America, which Abraham Lincoln called the last best hope of man on earth, was built on heroism and noble sacrifice. It was built by men and women like our seven star voyagers, who answered a call beyond duty, who gave more than was expected or required, and who gave it little thought of worldly reward. We think back to the pioneers of an earlier century, the sturdy souls who took their families and their belongings and set out into the frontier of the American West. Often they met with terrible hardship. Along the Oregon Trail, you can still see the grave markers of those who fell on the way. But grief only steeled them to the journey ahead. Today, the frontier is space and the boundaries of human knowledge. Sometimes when we reach for the stars, we fall short. But we must pick ourselves up again and press on, despite the pain. Our nation is indeed fortunate that we can still draw on immense reservoirs of courage, character, and fortitude. That we're still blessed with heroes like those of the Space Shuttle Challenger."
Nobody did that better than Reagan, JFK, Roosevelt, Lincoln. They knew how to stir the souls of men. No Democrat, no Republican stuff. That was their greatness. Well, there was a report that was commissioned. And, well, we know what caused it. The Challenger investigation report even had a chapter titled "An Accident Rooted in History." The failure was traced to O-ring seals in the rocket booster joints, but the real question isn't which parts failed. It's why those parts were in the boosters at all by 1986. It had turned out there had just been some bureaucratic snafus, and that's what can happen with bureaucracies. But everyone learned. Here's the quote from the report. "The space shuttle's solid rocket booster problem began with a faulty design of its joint and increased as both NASA and contractor management failed first to recognize it as a problem, then failed to fix it, and finally treated it as an acceptable flight risk." And the rest is history. And on this day in history, brought to you by Hillsdale College, the Space Challenger explosion. Let's go off with where we started.
"The shuttle mission will launch." My God.
1:15.
There's been an explosion.
Velocity 2,900 feet per second. Altitude 9 nautical miles. Downrange distance 7 nautical miles.
This is not standard. This is not something that is planned, of course. I can see a solid rocket booster has broken away from shuttle Challenger. That's what you're looking at in the middle of your screen. I cannot see the shuttle itself.
This This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And if you're looking for news or hot talk, well, that's not what we do here. But we do like to talk about the things that, well, really affect most Americans, from health to the arts to, in this particular case, housing. And we came across a very good article in the Wall Street Journal from the housing reporter there. And Laura Cusisto joins us now. Thanks, Laura, for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much.
You bet. What drew you to this story, Laura? You've been covering it. You've been covering housing for one of the great papers in the United States, and this is your beat. What have you been observing, and why this particular piece, which had a headline, U.S. apartment rents leap at fastest pace since housing crisis?
Well, I think in general, everyone is very focused on home prices and home ownership, but a huge portion of the country rents, and there's a real affordability problem for a lot of those people. Rents, as we say in the article, really leaped at their fastest pace since before the recession this last year, and that's affecting people everywhere from San Francisco to New York, but also even smaller cities like Nashville, and it's a real challenge for folks.
Well, and when the housing crisis hit, it became, obviously, there were new loan requirements, new rules in place. So for a lot of folks, it became harder to qualify for mortgages. So is this a supply-demand problem in the end that's driving this spike?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few different forces that are converging. One is that it is more difficult to get a mortgage, and then you layer on top of that the fact that as rents go up, it gets harder to save for a down payment, and so that keeps folks renting even longer. You had both a combination of people who lost their homes to foreclosure who ended up renting, and then you also have younger people who are renting longer, both because of demographic changes, but also because I think people are much more hesitant to go and take on a big mortgage these days. They've seen what other people went through a decade ago. And so that's just created a much larger population of renters. And in the meantime, supply just really hasn't been catching up until the last year or so. There's been really very little construction because it's just also very hard to get a loan to build a new apartment building because we went through such a bruising real estate crash.
And let's look at some of the just sheer raw numbers, if you could, Laura. Talk about, first, the home ownership rates. They're at record lows. Give us what the highs were, what they're at now, and just give us a broader context for, A, what's going on in the home ownership world, because obviously this reflects concurrently on what's actually going on in the rental world.
Right. So I just a new homeownership rate came out today, and there's some indication that it might finally be bottoming out somewhere around 63.7%. It hasn't gone down for the last couple of quarters, but the typical homeownership rate is closer to about 65%. We were at one point up in the high 60s, and that doesn't sound like, I mean, this is a percentage difference or here or there, but in the context of the whole U.S. population, we're talking of millions of people who are homeowners versus, or who are renters now, who were once homeowners. I think the expectation is that the homeownership rate will start to creep back up, but it's very unlikely we'll see it go back up to the high 60s, just because there were probably a lot of people who were buying homes then, as we know, who really shouldn't have been. So we'll continue to see a large population of renters.
Yeah, now it may be the opposite, Laura. I mean, your reporting here indicated that home ownership rates in the third quarter stood at 63.7%. And here's the kicker, nearly a 30-year low. And so, again, as you explained, these seem like little percentages, but let's just use baseball as a metaphor. One extra hit every few games turns a guy from an average player into a Hall of Famer. And so these percentages really matter. What's this been on the impact for? What impact has this been on or had on family formation and the ability for young people, particularly Laura, to step out and seek to possibly own that first home?
It's something of a chicken and egg question. I think people don't know if young people are less interested in owning or if they have chosen to, or if they've ended up renting and decided to like renting because they can't own. But there's no question that young people are having a tough time getting into the homeownership market. Home prices have also gone up quite a bit. There's not a lot of inventory in the market, especially inventory at the lower price points. And so you're seeing younger people rent for longer and longer. You're also seeing, again, like kind of longer historical trends, young people getting married and having children later. And so it also sort of makes sense that they might wait to buy later. You're much more likely to want to rent and stay downtown and kind of where all the cool stuff is. But I think there's absolutely concern among some economists that as house prices rise, young people have missed the chance to get in and buy when they were relatively affordable, and now it's getting very tough for them to buy in some markets.
Well, that's the young. What about the working poor, Laura? What about the working poor?
Yeah, I think you saw a lot of those people. Those people obviously lose their homes during the foreclosure crisis, and a lot of those people ended up renting single-family homes. That was a really kind of common place for people who had a family but ended up renting. You aren't seeing so far big movements of those people who lost their homes going back and buying. There's some of that going on, but I think there are a number of different theories about why they're not. But one is that it was just sort of a very scarring experience, and that people prefer to stay renting.
Yeah, I've known quite a number of people who got burned so badly by the downturn they were overleveraged. And they're just terrified. But I know equally as many people who are in what I just call the renter's trap. And that is, as rents go up, they've just got no savings left. So they can't gear up for that down payment. And the banks, they want that down payment now. You're not hearing 5% down, 0% down. Those days are over.
Yeah, no, and the research bears out that both of those examples are happening for sure.
You know, one of the things I read another piece in the journal about in the apartment space, that the types of apartments that are flooding the market are for the high-end customers in cities, but that there's not been a ton of equivalent lower middle class and middle class rentals pouring into the market. Talk about that concentration since you're on the housing beat. I know it was a separate piece. I'm not sure if it was by you or not, but I saw that trend in the last week or two in the journal as well.
Yeah, so I mean, it's certainly always been the case that newer product, newer construction tends to fetch higher prices. But it also seems to be true that there's sort of statistics that support this, that that during this particular cycle, because construction costs have been high, because it's very difficult to get permits, land costs are high, projects are taking a long time to get built, that developers are really aiming product at the very, very high end. And there also seems to be demand for that. There are more professionals renting. There are more older retired couples renting who can afford those high rents, and that's been a real challenge. You're seeing much more rapid rent increases and much smaller vacancy rates in the kind of mid tier, and you're not really seeing any new construction for that, and so that's putting a particular squeeze on people who are renting those mid priced apartments.
Now, tell me in this space, give us a sense of the aggregate increases over the last, let's say, decade or so. In terms of rentals, how much more is the average rent today than it was a year ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago? Give us a context for this, Laura.
Sure. So I'll give you 5 years ago, because that's probably the best comparison. The last decade was a pretty volatile one for the housing market. But if you go 5 years back, rents are about 20% more expensive than they were 5 years ago, which is a big increase, especially if you consider that people's incomes haven't grown at nearly that rate.
No, that's a big ticket item too. So when you're talking about a 20% increase on what may be the biggest family budget item, this is going to eat into a bunch of other things. And by the way, Laura, you add that in. I was in Des Moines yesterday, and I was talking to a taxi cab driver, and he couldn't give it up on both the rent increases and the increase in health care. And he just said, I can't work enough hours. He was working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and so was his wife. And they said, we just can't make it. We don't think we're ever getting out of the rental situation. And my heart broke, Laura. My heart broke.
Yeah. Oh, it's a really tough. It's a really tough spot. Especially, I mean, rent is not a really. It's not a discretionary expense. So you see people cutting back on other things, cutting back on entertainment, but even, you know, clothing budgets, food budgets, especially those working class renters. It's a real challenge.
Well, you know, I'm going to leave it with this, because we all know that there is a large federal subsidy for homeowners, And this is generally one of those tax deductions that favors those who have housing, and it's a rather large subsidy. What government policy? Is there discussion in this space? We're starting to talk about this a bit here on our show, but what's happening in policy circles about this crisis in rentals, Laura?
There are certainly groups that are advocating that we take a look at the mortgage interest deduction and that we create some kind of a subsidy for renters. I'm sure you can imagine it's very controversial. I think we're a long ways off from seeing any of that materialize, but there are absolutely groups that are arguing for that. And I think on the other hand, also, you're seeing cities really step up where there isn't a lot of federal subsidy for affordable rental production. You're seeing cities try to create programs to require affordable housing, cities trying to put money in from their budgets into affordable housing, because it's really, that's where you're really seeing the impact is on the ground in cities like New York and San Francisco and Nashville. And so you're seeing them kind of try to take a bit of a lead in stimulating affordable housing production.
Well, that's great to know, and it doesn't always have to be the federal government that steps in, and that's our belief here, though it's an interesting subject. And Laura, thanks for the reporting you do for the Wall Street Journal. We'd like you to come on regularly and talk about this big and important beat.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and once again, we talk about the things you care about, housing, the Wall Street Journal's beat reporter on the space. This is Our American Stories, and we'll be back after these messages.
Taught to fear Jesus in a small town. Used to daydream in that small town. Another boring romantic, that's me. But I've seen it all in a small town. Had myself a